Republican Representative Dale Coinga has been working on tax reform since he came to the Assembly. How many years ago? Third term? Fourth term?
7 years ago.
7 years
2011,
ago.
2011, yeah.
And then last fall, you were asked to also work on a potential transportation funding solution.
That's correct.
And then last Thursday, you took some basic principles to your caucus, and you came out and announced those. And it's a pretty ambitious, bold plan. So thank you so much for coming to Wisconsin to talk about it.
Thanks for having me. This is the venue for it.
It is, indeed.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Some of this stuff takes a little longer than 30 seconds to explain. And
right.
I appreciate you guys had the format where you actually could talk about the substance. So
your choice. You want to talk about transportation funding or income tax first?
Let's go with the income tax side first.
Okay, income tax. Your goal is a flat tax.
Yes.
By 2030. Mm-hmm. Why does a flat tax make sense?
Well, if you look at studies out there, Wisconsin is losing people. And we're losing people to states that have a smaller or lower income tax than we do, or no income tax at all. And so this definitely doesn't compete still with Florida or a lot of other states, but it definitely marginalizes the difference between our states, where when people are retiring, maybe they say, hey, we'll spend the winter down there, but we'll still be residents of Wisconsin. I have spoken to a lot of people, both anecdotally, but also have looked at studies, and I really feel a clear direction to a lower tax rate changes the dynamic where more people stay in Wisconsin.
The Fiscal Bureau analysis of the 2015 income taxes, which I spent some time studying, mm-hmm. our effective tax rate now, let me be sure I get it right, is now about 4.35%. Your flat
right.
tax would take that to 3.98, but you'd phase it in over the next 12 years.
That's correct.
So it would be a tax cut.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the whole package is a tax cut. I mean, some people are worked up that the net revenue, which is done still through conservative means on the transportation side, we're talking about a little bit over $300 million in net new revenue mm-hmm. in the transportation fund. On the tax side, we're talking about over $2 billion in tax relief over this period of time. Net, we're talking about over $6 in tax cuts for every dollar in additional support in the transportation fund.
Right. Let's start at the basics. The Fiscal Bureau analysis of 2015, of the 3 million filers, 30% have no tax liability.
Right.
Is that a good thing? Why do 30% have no tax liability, Representative?
Well, Wisconsin is a very progressive state on income taxes. And if you look at WizTax, for example, that put a press release out a couple weeks ago, it really points out that we are one of the most generous states for folks that are on the lower spectrum of the income level. Not only are they not paying taxes, but what we do is we have a lot of refundable tax credits. And what that means is they're receiving negative taxes back. They file, it says you owe zero taxes, and you get money back. And so when you're doing that, you're putting pressure on more middle-class families mm-hmm. that then have to make up for that gap with a higher effective tax rate. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is a pragmatic approach. I'm sure some people won't, you know, phrase it that way, but we're doing very limited changes, actually no changes, to the refundable tax credit portion of it. But what we are doing is, as Jack Kemp called, spending through the tax code. We're changing and minimizing some of that spending through the tax code, and we're using that to help pay for this road to a flat tax while also paying for it with a little bit of economic growth.
But you target some pretty popular tax credits. The renter credit, $104 million. The marriage tax credit, $263.6 million. The exclusion on 30% of capital gains, $177.8 million. The phase out of the $150 million first dollar credit, $50 million in this budget.
In the out years, actually.
But do I have this right? You don't go after the $300 million credit for taxes paid in other states. So I guess my question is, why don't you just repeal all credits?
Well, obviously, if this was the Cato Institute, that may make sense. What the package is trying to do is politically navigate what could actually get passed. Okay, so we do touch the tax credit paid to other states. Wisconsin has a crazy system where we give you a dollar-for-dollar credit
yes.
when other states raise their taxes.
Right.
So we subsidize. If you have a business in California and Wisconsin, and California raises their tax, we subsidize that. That's very unique to Wisconsin.
Do you go after that?
We do go after that.
You do,
In every state but the bordering states. Oh. The reason for that is that would be detrimental to the Hudson area, the eastern side of the Minneapolis-St. Paul market. And so just from a politically pragmatic approach and also just being fair is we say for all the states that don't border Wisconsin, this will be our new policy. But I could go through those credits. Maybe there'll be a whole show on each of those credits.
Well,
but a lot of them are, you know,
those,
a lot of them
some of those are very popular. You and I probably claim them, and you wanna get rid of them or phase them out in favor of the greater good of the flat tax. Correct?
Absolutely. I mean, I think people would see net tax reductions. Most people would see net tax reductions by just getting rid of those and just simply lowering the rates. But things like the marriage credit. I mean, if you think about that credit, I know it sounds popular, but it only goes to people where both spouses are working. It's not for being married. It's for being married and have both spouses working. So okay. What that means that if your wife's having a baby and she takes off work to raise that child for a while, you lose that credit. So we're raising your taxes for having children. Or if your, God forbid, your spouse has cancer and they take off for a year because they're fighting cancer, once again, your taxes go up because both spouses aren't working. So when you look at those credits, a lot of them don't make sense. What we're saying is, okay, let's just eliminate this credit and use it for overall tax relief. So I know it's controversial, but you know, if we're going to continue to go down the road all the time on public policy saying, well, let's not do anything controversial, we're never going to get to the right policies. And so trying to clean up the tax code, and that's what we're doing.
Is your goal here postcard return?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because we've, you know, tried that many different times. The federal government also makes it very difficult on us because the federal government itself says you need to exempt this, you need to exempt that. A good example is bonds. You need to exempt insurance for bonds. They say you can't tax railroad pension income that was earned before 1967, right? So it is really difficult to get to a post-size tax return. But is that a goal? Absolutely. And would folks like myself work with guys like Paul Ryan on that goal over time? Absolutely.
Well, the average adjusted gross income in 2015 was, let me look at the number, since I got it from Fiscal Bureau, $55,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So if you apply the $55,000 AGI times your 3.98 flat tax, mm-hmm. that's what that filer would owe, correct?
Yeah, I mean, very generally speaking. I mean, we still retain a portion of itemized credit. We still retain a portion of the property tax credit. There's a lot of credits that are retained. So, you know, once again, this is not meant to be like, here's the utopian tax code or utopian transportation package. What we're saying is, okay, this is a reasonable, pragmatic way to get to a flat tax over a period of time.
Okay. Now, on that, the average AGA filer, $56,532, I found it on my notes, times 3.98, they would pay $2,249. Now let's take it to someone with an AGI of $150,000 times 3.98 flat tax, $5,970. Now I don't know enough to answer.
Did you phase out that standard deduction over time?
Well,
because that's still in there, so it's still
that's my question.
Progressive, right? Okay. Now you're not going to hear the Democrats point that out, but there's an element of progressive taxation still embedded underneath the flat tax, right? Because Wisconsin still has a lot of credits that phase out with income, or standard deduction phases out with income. And so even with that flat tax, I'm not trying to be gimmicky about any of this stuff, it's still a flat tax rate, but there's still a lot of portions that have a progressive element to it that the simple math you just gave is complicated by the fact that they would actually still be paying a higher effective rate than the first family you mentioned at a lower income.
Thank you for that clarification. But isn't our current system progressive when, again, drawing on the LFB analysis in 2015, 7% of taxpayers with AGIs of $150,000 or more paid 41% of our personal income tax in 2015. Isn't that progressive? And under your plan, would that progressivity stay?
Our plan would make it less progressive. But here's a deck of cards we're against. The Trump tax plan that has been talked about for years says we may no longer allow you to take deductions or credit for your state and local taxes.
And we're a high tax.
We are a very high tax state. And so if you look at that, if that goes off the table, there is going to be tremendous pressure on those individuals that you just mentioned that disproportionately pay our bills in Wisconsin to say, I'm out, because that federal action would indirectly raise their taxes, and it would compound the reality that their attorneys and their CPAs would say, you know, live in Wisconsin for 100 days a year, you can hang out with your kids and your friends, but I recommend you spend over 200 days a year
in Florida,
somewhere that doesn't have an income tax, right?
Right.
And so that's the sense of urgency we have here, is that that's a possibility. And from the federal level, they're in discussions like, why should we be subsidizing states that have higher taxes? I don't want to see them do it because I want to see Wisconsin have a lower tax burden. I want to represent Wisconsin. But that argument may have some strength, so we need to get out ahead of that.
Well, our system, I don't have to tell you as a CPA and a veteran CPA, deductions, credit, and exemptions. But here's my question. In the 7 years that you've been looking at tax reform, have we taken any steps towards some of the fairness that's your goal, or have we made it worse by adding additional credits and exemptions? You haven't even touched the long list of sales tax exemption, but that's the subject of another show.
Right.
So over 7 years, are we getting towards a fair tax code or stepping away from that?
You know, I've had arguments with folks where LFB says you could argue it both ways. I mean, there's elements of our tax code that have definitely made it more flatter. And we collapse the bracket, for example.
Yeah.
But then there's other elements, like the manufacturing activities credit, which does the opposite of that. And so definitely, you know, I think it's up to like what part of the tax code you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to gauge that.
Now, you and I have heard the Democrats scream, is the right term, about the manufacturing tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
Does your plan do anything to that?
Yeah, so what we do is we cap, as the rates go down, we cap the percentage that can be carried over in the future. We want to make it very specific that this is for activity associated with labor, right? Because we want Wisconsin's manufacturing agriculture sector to continue to grow. So we do minimize that credit and make some changes to it.
Now, I think there were 40 members of your caucus at the Thursday press conference. Pretty impressive. But I didn't see any senators. I know you've been working with Senator Markline, also a CPA, and Senator Capping is another member of the CPA caucus. Are your Senate members of the CPA caucus on board with the plan that you announced Thursday?
Well, I mean, first of all, is with the 40 members in the assembly, I mean, there's a lot of members not there that day. I heard some members actually came and they were like, the room is packed, I can't get in there. So I think it really represents the team. And I can't tell you like how personally a lot of members said, I have a problem with this portion of the plan, mm-hmm. I have a problem with this portion of the plan, but I get it, I respect what you've tried to do, and I'm standing, and that means a lot to me personally, and I know the speaker as well. So that's, I think, a huge accomplishment. You're not going to see the Democrats in the assembly do a plan. I'll put specifics out there. You're not going to see the Democrats in the Senate do that. And so I think that speaks volumes of the strength of our caucus. So I'm sorry, give me your question.
No, the question is,
question? You've
worked extensively with Senator Markline.
The senators.
Let's just talk about income.
And so this represents the going through the plan. Is I try not to worry about certain senators or certain the governors. I try to focus on what do I believe in and what do I know we need to accomplish. And focus on the caucus. If I was going to look at each individual that's elected in the Senate and the governor, mm-hmm. I think I'd be still spinning around circles. And so the process by which we took it was to work within the caucus, work with stakeholders outside the building throughout the entire state, and then formulate a plan that's consistent with our principles and solves problems. And we're looking at a 10-year view on transportation, a 10-year view on taxes, and saying this puts us in a trajectory where we lower our tax burden, we fix our roads, we make our transportation more solvent, and we no longer put this pressure on the general fund by making the transportation fund independent, 100% independent from the general fund. And so that's what, the senators have a lot of stuff in the plan that they have applauded. Particularly, you mentioned my fellow CPAs, Senator Kapinga and Senator Markline.
Right.
But as far as the whole plan, them adopting, no, they're not doing that. And we have a better relationship now than ever, and they have concerns with parts of the plan, and they embrace other parts of the plan. And so the process is that even those guys are good friends, like we have the assembly package now, we're going to go forward, it's a discussion point, it's a flag, and then there's three co-equal branches of government, right? Governor, or in the legislative and the executive side, the governor, the Senate, and the assembly. And we're going to have responsible conversations about the substance of it and see where we end up.
Before we turn to the transportation funding, just one last question on your income tax reform. Which of all the elements in your income tax changes do you consider non-negotiable? If one thing passed in this budget, one or two, which ones?
You know, Steve, what I've been trying to do this whole process is there's been a lot of people that put lines in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that in D.C. I see that in state government. And putting lines in the sand, I think, really puts yourself and your colleagues in a tight spot. And so I try not to do that as far as lines in the sand. I think negotiate and look at the overall package is a responsible thing to do. And I think what people are very frustrated with, whether it be DC or state governments, is this paralysis even within single party control, because you have all these people with lines in the sand, and then you can't be flexible enough to figure out how to work that out. And I've given this considerable thought, being kind of in the fog of war in politics. Yeah. And I can't help but think that in previous generations, you had a significant amount of veterans that served, and they literally went to war together, and so they understand that it's not easy, it's not simple, and it's messy at times. And I think that dynamic really helped people come together and say, man, I know this isn't easy. I know this is, you need to, you know, crack some eggs to make an omelet. I think all these drawing the lines in the sand and lack of perspective sometimes makes it all the more complicated in 2017 for responsible parties to sit down and make responsible compromises and come to responsible solutions. And so you won't hear lines in the sand from me, and I'm going to try to be the person behind closed doors trying to reconcile differences and move forward on these fronts.
Okay, now let's talk about transportation funding. You'd cut our 30.9-cent gas tax, which hasn't been increased since 2006.
Correct.
When we dropped indexing. You'd lower that by 4.8 cents, but extend the 5% sales tax to gasoline sales. That's a form of indexing, isn't it? Because as gas prices rise or fall, tax collections would go up or down depending on the price of gas, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It provides some flexibility in the transportation fund long term with natural inflation. You know, right now in the transportation fund, all the inputs are 100% fixed. The gas tax is fixed, and the registration fee is fixed, and the federal dollars fluctuate a little bit. They could go up, they could go down, right? So in the general fund, if you have inflation, it all adjusts, right? Because sales inflation goes up, you get more sales tax revenue, wages go up, you get more income tax revenue. So the general fund naturally fluctuates based on inflation. The general fund, if you have 2% inflation for 10 years, minus compounding of interest, you're going to have 20% less in your transportation fund. Couple this up with new technology and fuel efficiency,
yes. And
you're looking at a death spiral, especially when you have infrastructure going towards the end of its life, and you also have more bonding, right? And you have more and more bonding, which puts more pressure on there as well. And so this is a pragmatic way to say, okay, this allows some flexibility as naturally prices go up over time to have more flexibility in the fund to deal with the infrastructure needs.
And it seems to me that your approach on transportation funding was top priority, reduce the governor's proposed bonding from 500 to 200.
Correct.
That was your top goal. So how can we do that? And do you do that then with the minimum markup part?
Mm-hmm.
So I know what you said at the press conference. You can't predict the stock market. I can't either. But you really think the $2.21.9 that you and I can buy gas for would not increase once you do with the three moving parts, cut the gas tax, extend the sales tax, and then minimum markup.
So let's take this out of the capital
okay. And
the policy world,
yes. And
let's talk about this on the street.
Yes.
So there's a gentleman in northern Wisconsin. He contacted me. He's actually been sued for violating the minimum markup law.
Oh, because he's got stores in both Michigan and Wisconsin.
He's got stores in both Michigan and Wisconsin.
Now, I patronized his stores. Yeah.
Listen to this carefully. This is fascinating. Michigan has higher gas taxes, significantly higher gas taxes. His gas in Wisconsin is more expensive from the same wholesaler than his gas in Michigan.
Because
now he says, and he's in the market, he says that this plan will lower Wisconsin's gas prices even after we apply the sales tax and reduce the gas tax. He says that the gas prices at his stores will be lower than Michigan, which right now they are actually higher than Michigan. That is fascinating. And here's what conservatives have done consistently on so many different areas, whether it be Dodd-Frank or the Affordable Care Act or the coal mandates from the Obama administration, is we've made arguments that when there's bad public policy and you put mandates out there, mm-hmm. then what you're doing is you're indirectly taxing. And what matters is not if you call it a fee or a tax or a policy that creates higher electric bills or higher insurance coverage, is money out of your pocket is a tax. The minimum markup law is the most generous in the country. We are only one of two states that actually tell you, this is the markup, you have to market. You have to mark it up 9%. And so the argument is that bad policy creates a tax. And by lowering that, because not everyone in the caucus thinks we should get rid of it, I do, but by lowering that from a little over 9% down to 3%, you're taking off that pressure and you're lowering the indirect taxes from bad policy paid by people at the pump, and then you're also solving the transportation problem. And this isn't theoretical pen and paper in my office. This is a guy on the street saying, here's the reality and here's what's going to happen. It's going to lower gas prices.
But I want to go back to the regional consideration. He operates stores in Michigan and Wisconsin.
Right.
Is that just a regional phenomenon, or do you think that'll be the case statewide?
I think it would be the case statewide. I think that argues a compare and contrast to the market because it's so close. I mean, those two gas stations he mentioned are 8 miles away. Mm-hmm. But what I went through this whole package, because I think the cornerstone of why we had so many members of our caucus getting out there is being authentic and real on this and not, you know, selling something that isn't true. I'm not going to make promises because I think you should be leery of elected officials that tell you, I'm going to tell you exactly how the market's going to react because it's the market. We don't know what the stock market's going to do. We don't know what the market's going to do, right? It's dependent on a lot of different factors. So I'm not going to make promises. But I could tell you from that example, I think that there'll be tremendous pressure downward on the pump. And I think it will be net-net, very close, negligible, or maybe even a cut. And, you know, people are concerned, well, don't the sales taxes go up as the price of fuel goes up? So does the minimum markup law. Right?
Right. 9.18%.
Right. Your variability on prices is being crossed out by those two changes. And that's why someone else pointed out to me, it's very much like Act 10, right? Like Act 10, there's general fund pressure from having bad public policies related to public employees that mm-hmm. cost taxpayers money. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we took the pressure off the general fund by making changes to the policies related to public employees, which actually put us on trajectory with the general fund's a lot more solvent. We're in much better shape. Similar concept of transportation fund is we're saying there's a bad policy in place, we're going to reform that policy, and that's going to provide less pressure on the pump, and now we have the ability to spend some more money on our transportation system that is being over-reliant on bonding, which is going to compound and cost us more in the future.
That was an amazing figure. If we bonded at $500 million, it would cost an additional $150 over the lifetime of the bonds?
No, it's actually...
Correct me on that.
Yeah, so $500 million is the bonding.
Yes.
Fiscal Bureau says you take approximately half of that bonding and add that in interest over the life of the bonds.
Okay.
So if we reduce bonding by $300 million,
yes,
then that's going to save $150.
Yeah,
right?
Thanks.
If we were somehow going to say, okay, we're going to get rid of all $500 million, that would save $250
over the life of the bond.
On just interest.
Yes.
And $750 with the principal portion.
Right.
And, you know, some of us that had mortgages on the front end and see that going down over time, we understand the impact of compound interest. You know, the power of interest is strong. And some people say when they sell, it's like, oh, it's like a mortgage. All we're doing is like a mortgage. No. A mortgage is when you buy a house. You pay that off over 15 years, let's say, or 30 years, and that what are you left with? You're left with a house mm-hmm. that has value, and you're probably going to sell that for more. Now, take that concept to transportation.
This is the biggest, largest,
most of the time, right?
It's the largest purchase
especially
we all
over
make.
15, 30 years.
Yeah.
So you have an asset, and you're able to sell that, right? Now, take the same concept with a road. You have the bonds usually for 20 years. You pay that down, and you have for 20 years. There's no private market for that road. There's no... Value left
you have
road.
Maintenance costs on that road.
You have maintenance costs. And now what do you have? Now it's at the end of its life. Now you need to do it again. So it's very different when a mortgage is actually building property value and then you have an asset at the end of it. Like stewardship, for example, like you're doing bonding, you're paying it off. At the end of that bonding, you still have the land, right? Like transportation is very different. You're doing the bonding. It depreciates all the way down to having to be replaced. And now you spend all the money on interest. And now you got to start over, and it's this continuous cycle of using more and more debt to pay for your problems. And that's why I'm saying, okay, let's look at the 10-year, 20-year plan here. We need to lower our bonding to have more money for labor and concrete and less money for interest to bondholders, which are primarily outside the state of Wisconsin.
I want to ask you to respond to the governor's comments. Now, he's still studying your tax plan. But here's what he said over the weekend about the transportation funding. The Assembly transportation package raises taxes on gas by over $430 million at a time when we have a reformed dividend on Wisconsin. We do not need any new taxes on middle-class taxpayers. I'm not saying that, Representative. The governor is. Your response?
Right. So I think the $430 million, if you were going to like pick one number, like, oh, that's jaw-dropping, the $430 million is artificially high. The reason for that is we're stopping $80 million of transfer from the general fund,
from the general fund to transportation.
So that's included in that 430.
Right.
And what we're doing there is we're lowering income taxes by that, right? And we're lowering it for middle-class families. So the people using the roads more pay more, and then generally the people working and middle-class income tax see cuts, right? So that's $80 million of that. The other part of that
so
is...
down to $350.
Yep.
Yep.
And the other part of that is now there is the 0.5% county sales tax he mentioned.
Yeah,
what we do,
grabbed 63 of that.
We
grabbed
that.
Excuse me.
Because what we do with that is we say, let's lower our income taxes more. So the state retains that portion in order to once again lower the price of the make sure we're lowering taxes overall, right?
Yep.
So that's another $63 million, where it makes it sound like we're raising taxes by $430 million.
Yep. Now you're done.
Like my argument is that but we're actually lowering the income taxes for people working, and we're having people pay for the roads. So where does that leave us there, Steve? What are we left down to?
We're down to about 297.
Okay.
290.
Okay, so yeah, you're down to 290, less than $300 million.
Right.
And even when I did the math earlier, I thought there was $8 million additional in there. $8 million in new revenue.
Yeah.
That some people cite as like a tax is actually revenue to the fund, because that's $8 million in savings from not doing the bonding. So all in all, I think the realistic number, I will concur, and it's not comfortable for me to say because I like to be a tax cutter, that net, yes, there will be more than $300 million of revenue from these moves, but it's done in a conservative way. It's done by getting rid of a exemption of the sales tax, and we're lowering the gas tax, and net's $300 million. But I still would go back to the argument that we as conservatives argue that taxes come in many different forms, and by taking off the bad policy on the minimum markup law, that is a tax that could be considered a tax. And when you take that pressure off, I think you're getting to a very negligible, if not a tax cut, on just the transportation side, not to mention that this is coupled with a huge income tax cut.
But your package doesn't inject any new major source of money to avoid the delays in some of these major projects, right?
That is correct. In this 2 years.
In this 2 years.
But you need to look at the long term over 10
when
years.
When you save money on debt service.
Exactly. So you're saving money on debt service,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
The tune of, in this budget, just $8 million. Over the life of the bonds, $150
million.
But then the out years, too, is you now have that revenue stream there. And so when you're looking at, right now we're at 22 cents on the dollar going to...
Debt service. Principal and interest.
Now, when you add that revenue on top, that automatically drops, right? Numerator, denominator issues.
Yep.
And we're lowering our debt service. So now you have a lot more flexibility if you have to leverage or you have the cash. Is that now when you're looking at a 10-year plan on transportation, you are in a much better position than you were previously if you look at the longer picture. And that's what I'm trying to do here is we need to look at what does it look like with transportation and our taxes. Two of the key economic drivers in our state, I want Republicans to be the governing party of Wisconsin like they are in South Dakota and Texas. And if we're going to be the governing party of Wisconsin, we need to solve problems. And this takes a 10-year view at the problems in taxation and a 10-year view of the problems of transportation and creates manageable, fiscally conservative solutions.
Just one more wrap-up on this issue. You saw the statement from County Executive Abley over the weekend. That would force by voiding their wheel tax of $30 per vehicle, that would force a $7 million cut in their transit system, which would reduce service to the people of Milwaukee and the Milwaukee area. Any response?
Yeah, I mean, like we said, this is all a starting point. We definitely want to slow down or put a moratorium on wheel taxes. There's no doubt about that. And then instead give a local option, part-time, minimal sales tax. Representative Peterson's worked very hard on that.
Maximum 8 years, correct?
Maximum 8 years, four right. years approved by the voters, specific projects. And so we'll work with the county on that and figure out what makes sense. We definitely don't want to hurt transit. I personally believe that transit's many times helpful connecting people with jobs. And so we'll discuss that with the county and make sure that we're doing what's right.
You and your caucus are getting credit for putting forth a formal plan.
Mm-hmm.
Your plan puts the ball in whose court now, both on taxes and transportation funding?
That's an interesting question. I think from my perspective is I've not been elected leadership. The caucus elected Robin Voss as leadership. They had a Representative Jim Steinecke as leadership. And so I understand what my role was. My role was to put a plan out there. Mm-hmm. I've done that. I think questions of that nature are probably better suited for the speaker and the majority leader.
One other thing that occurred to me on transportation funding. In 2011, the governor recommended using sales tax revenues from the sale of vehicles and vehicle parts and transfer that to the transportation plan.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, that's what we're doing away with in the transfer of the general fund and the transportation fund.
Yeah.
We're replacing that, saying, okay, let's leave that in the general fund.
That's $80 million.
It's $80 million, and like, let's just have the fees directly on fuel pay for that portion of it. And once again, we use that for overall income tax relief. I think, you know, let's let the fund stand on its own. And so that's what we're trying to do. And so I understand the rationale there. I don't think the transfer of money from the general fund to the transportation fund is as egregious as the Doyle transfers to the transportation fund or the general fund. I think there's arguments you can make that like everyone indirectly uses our roads. But I would really like to see fund integrity. Mm-hmm. There's a reason we have two different funds. And I think if you use the roads, you should pay for the roads. And by having a segregated fund that gets all its revenue from people using those roads, you accomplish that objective and you get the pressure off the general fund. And the pressure off the general fund allows you to do more tax cuts, allow more money for schools and other priorities in that general fund.
Okay, in the final seconds, two questions on different subjects.
Oh, yeah.
You were very active 2 years ago in MPS and
yep.
the Opportunity Schools. You've obviously been spending a lot of time on transportation and income tax reform.
Yep.
But do you envision another reform plan for MPS? Because you and I know the four-year graduation rate at MPS is still about 55%.
Yes.
Are you going to have another MPS reform plan in this budget?
I think the word reform is thrown around loosely.
Okay.
I don't know how.
Major pilot opportunities or something?
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, they'll definitely be doing stuff for MPS. It's very close to my heart. It's close to Senator Darling's heart. I think that it's the first step of economic development and wholesome families and a great community. And the stats you just mentioned are just jaw-dropping and don't serve anyone except the status quo. And so we're going to be looking at, you know, the governor put a lot of money in education, largest increase ever. What we'd like to see is some of that money maybe dedicated to third-party organizations like a reading corps that has been very successful in other states to increase the amount of proficiency of reading using exact science and volunteers. Also, there's a place called College Possible that's been very successful in connecting high school students with college options. And so taking that money and trying to see if we can do something with organizations that have a lot of people on there that have business mindsets and know what's working and have a heart for change, and see if we could have those folks work with MPS to make changes. And
Do these organizations now exist, Representative?
Yes. Yep.
They do.
Yep. Very
okay.
successfully.
Are they nonprofit or for profit?
Not-for-profit.
Non-for-profit.
And what's cool about that, they exist and they have metrics we can look at and say, yes, you're actually executing, you're getting things done. And so that's what I want to support and work alongside Dr. Darian Driver and her dedication to make this school district better.
And then the final question is, with all your work on the tax packages, where are you in the U.S. Senate? Are you still thinking of running?
Yeah, I mean, I'm true is that I said I have a job to do, and there's so many people out there that are elected to an office, and then they're like, and I'm thinking about running for this office, and they do that. And so why do you run for office? You run for office because you want to solve problems. And oh my gosh, I've been handed the opportunity to solve some problems here. So
you haven't had a chance.
I'm gonna do that first. Talk about that later.
Is that okay? But you're not taking yourself out of the mix for U.S. Senate, are you?
I'm not taking myself out of the mix. I'm not putting myself in the mix.
I understand. Representative Dale Coenga, a key member of the Joint Finance Committee and a CPA, represents the 14th District. And Dale, thanks so much for the update.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I like spit towards the end there.